back at 11 o'clock to take on. All right, so we're going to take on item number 10, which is a presentation regarding the recovery plan for the evolutionarily significant unit of Central California Coast coho salmon. This morning we have Charlotte Ambrose, who's a fishery biologist and the coho recovery coordinator for the NOAA National Marine Fisheries Service. Ms. Ambrose is the descendant of multiple generations of fishermen and fisherwomen of the North Coast. Her enduring dedication to the plight of native salmonids has led to her become a champion and spokesperson for fisheries recovery and watershed protection across the state. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for that marvelous introduction. I very much appreciate it, and thank you, Matt, and thank you, the board, for inviting me here today. My name is Charlotte Ambrose. I am the NOAA Fisheries Recovery Coordinator for Central Coast Salmon and Steelhead. I also want to ask for your forgiveness for my PowerPoint presentation today. It's a lot of information in a short period of time, so just hold on, and my hope is that the threads, the pieces that I provide in the beginning will form a tapestry of recovery at the end.
Okay. Can we get the lights a little bit?
But first, I want to say happy birthday. Happy birthday to the Federal Endangered Species Act. 2013 marks its 40th anniversary, and so many species have benefited. Species like the northern spotted owl, the whooping crane, the bald eagle, the peregrine falcon, and so many more. It was enacted by Congress and signed into law by President Richard Nixon December 28, 1973, and it was established to safeguard the nation's natural heritage by conserving species in danger of extinction for the enjoyment and benefit of current and future generations. So when a species is listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act, it becomes the responsibility of the federal agencies to develop a plan for the species recovery. The United States Fish and Wildlife Service oversees recovery plan development for terrestrial species, and NOAA Fisheries, for whom I work for, oversees the development of recovery plans for marine or anadromous species such as salmon and steelhead. The Endangered Species Act requires three things in recovery plans: site-specific management actions, objective, measurable criteria that, when met, would result in the determination that the species be removed from the list, and estimates of time and cost to recovery. Across the Pacific Northwest, there are 27 populations of salmon and steelhead listed as federally threatened or endangered. And we are organized in our recovery planning efforts by what we call recovery domains. So there is a recovery domain, and one or more populations are assigned to that domain. There's science center support and a recovery coordinator, such as myself, responsible for facilitating the development, finalization, and implementation of the recovery plan for that domain. Now, there are regional differences between the Northwest region and the Southwest region. Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, recovery plan development is more of a state and stakeholder-led process. They develop the plans, they submit those to our agency. Here in California, we don't have that state and stakeholder infrastructure. So the plans are being led by me and our staff, and we reach out to the state and the stakeholders to build, hopefully, that societal safety net so that we can have the same type of infrastructure, societal infrastructure that the Northwest region has. You, I'm sure, have heard that there is no longer a Northwest region and a Southwest region, NOAA. We are one NOAA across the West. Our Long Beach office is no longer our regional office. Our regional office is in Seattle. Rod McGinnis, our regional administrator, and Kevin Chu, our assistant regional administrator, have been replaced by Will Stell and Barry Thome. They were here yesterday describing how the merger is looking. Protected Resources Division, for whom I work for, and the Habitat Division, for whom, like Joe Dillon and probably Melanie Harrison, who you've seen here before, in the Habitat Division, those divisions are merging. If you have questions about the merger at the end of my presentation, I'm happy to answer whatever information I can share. So of the 27 populations, there are 10 salmon and steelhead here in California, and we have to write recovery plans for all 10. The 10 are organized into four recovery domains: Southern Oregon, Northern California, Central Valley, South Central Coast and North Central Coast. And we have some recovery plans that are done and many more that are in development. The ones that are done were done last year in 2012. For me, we finished Central California Coast Coho in September, and the Southern California Steelhead was finished in January. We have three underway, which I'll talk about later in my presentation. And also, just a reminder, we do have a state Coho recovery strategy for Coho. My domain extends from Redwood Creek up in Humboldt County, south through the San Francisco and including the San Francisco Bay tributaries to Aptos Creek and Santa Cruz. I have four species: Northern California Steelhead, California Coastal Chinook Salmon, Central California Coast Steelhead, and Central California Coast Coho. Coho's done, and we are currently working on developing the recovery plan for the remaining three species. Key components to a recovery plan: to have site-specific management actions that improve impaired habitats, reduce threats, plan for natural events, that increase the survival and abundance of the species. And then a tracking system, which we call our objective measurable criteria, to determine whether or not we're achieving that over time. Federal recovery planning in California goes something like this. We have a NOAA Science Center-led technical recovery team that provides the biological underpinnings of the recovery plan. They are provided to us in two technical memoranda, which are called the historical population structure and biological viability criteria. Those memoranda are provided to me, and I work with our staff and the public scientists, agencies, others, to prepare all the other aspects of the recovery plan, including moving it through co-manager and public reviews for a final. So bear with me. The biological underpinnings are framed with the hypothesis that extinction risk for a species increases as it departs from its historical structure. And we know that for salmon and steelhead, these populations are supported by relatively constant processes that have occurred over long time frames. So these constants are what was used by the Science Center to model this historical structure. Channel gradient, discharge, valley width, and mean annual air temperature were the constants that were put into a model to characterize this historical structure, what we call the intrinsic potential of streams to historically support salmon and steelhead. This is prior to anthropogenic effects. The model is what we call viable conditions, and the IP extent itself is what we use to generate our spawner density targets for our recovery. And then what the Science Center also did was they took the overall listed range and they grouped, they came up with groupings under which species evolved and similar environmental situations under which populations evolved, which we call diversity strata. One thing that I do want to say is that because they gave us this IP model, it doesn't necessarily mean that we used it verbatim. We know that we can't push the reset button. And so we took the IP and we put a more contemporary lens, understanding that we can achieve viability without actually realizing that historical state under which the species evolved. So we can accept a lower threshold for recovery. Okay, so what am I really talking about? The evolutionarily significant unit for salmon, or the distinct population segment for steelhead, is organized into diversity strata. And in each diversity strata, we have populations which coincide with either watersheds or subwatersheds assigned to that strata. So the framework here is that for an ESU or DPS to be viable, we need viable strata. And for a strata to be viable, stratum to be viable, we need populations persisting or viable. And we need individuals surviving across their life stages for a population to be viable or persist. So you're probably wondering why I'm going through all this minutia. Well, this hierarchy, individual survival across life stages, population persistence and viability leading to diversity strata viability, and all diversity strata viable leading to ESU or DPS recovery, is the same hierarchy that we used when we evaluated habitat conditions and threats. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later, but this hierarchy is carried through in our analysis. So that was a summary of the historical population structure memorandum. And then we had the biological viability criteria. In a nutshell, it basically tells us what we need, how many we need, where we need them, those kinds of things. But no matter how many formulas that the Science Center can give us, the number one metric that's driving these viability criteria are spawner abundances over time. And that is a real fish, by the way. It's in Sacramento. Chinook. So our approach is to operate at the life stage scale so that we can achieve overall ESU or DPS recovery. And it really is recovering the various, threading the pieces together across life stages to save salmon from the headwaters to the sea. So how do we do that when 4,000 eggs, as it moves through across its life stages, only ends up to be about 2 spawning adults? So our goal is to define conditions that can increase the probability of survival across its various life stages. So what does an egg need in terms of habitat conditions to survive in the nest or the reds created by the spawning adults? And the alevin, when it breaks out of the egg, it's still in those interstitial gravels. What does it need to survive to become a juvenile? And what does a juvenile need to survive 1 to 3 years in the stream environment, depending on species, to become a smolt? And what does a smolt need in its off-channel habitats, estuarine habitats, so that we have a lot of smolts and big smolts going out, because we know that the number and size of smolts is directly proportional and related to the spawners that we get returning. So it's about increasing the survival probability at each and across each life stage. Now, salmon die after they spawn, so we can't really increase the probability of survival for this life stage. But the decaying bodies are still, nonetheless, a pretty important component to the system and nutrients to the juveniles. Steelhead don't die after they spawn. They'll come back several times. So what we call this, in terms of defining these habitat conditions, life stage gateways, and we characterize these for each life stage, determine what kind of habitat conditions are needed, and then develop criteria, very similar to what the TMDL folks are doing, you know, developing temperature criteria, sediment criteria, to help, and then looking at the information and data that's available to us to make determinations on whether or not those factors are limiting or not for the life stages. It's a fairly large geographic area and a lot of populations. There's actually 118 different watersheds or sub-watersheds that we're analyzing for recovery of crop for my domain. So we needed a place to house our information, a protocol to conduct an analysis that was systematic for all populations, that where we could actually start making comparisons between what's limiting in one population versus another. I'm not going to go through this protocol except just to tell you it's a Nature Conservancy protocol called the Conservation Action Planning Workbook. It's been used globally by many conservation organizations to characterize current conditions and to forecast future threats. And we use this protocol for our recovery plan analysis. We reached out, once we developed the criteria, to compile information and data, and we got information from the water board staff. I am here to say we are not data limited. We are limited in our ability to compile and analyze because there is such a decentralized monitoring system here in California. And there are a lot of partners who are very willing to share their information with us. The challenge for us became, how do we take the information and not compare apples against oranges? The most comprehensive data set was the California Department of Fish and Game habitat typing data. It took me 2 years to secure this, but we're quite happy that we did. All of the in-stream habitat typing data are in ACCESS databases. And these databases are at reach scales. And because it's in an ACCESS database, we developed queries and scripts so that we could aggregate these data at a reach level at a sub-watershed level, at a population level, and then, of course, we could start looking at things across a whole watershed or even comparing them between populations or between watersheds. And these data helped us characterize those types of criteria you're most familiar with, pool depths, pool frequency ratios, embeddedness values, all the kinds of data sets that are collected by Fish and Game, and we use these data to inform us in our analysis. We have visual representations of the table, thank goodness for Google Earth. We have a data catalog and library that talks about our processing steps for the data. And of course, we had to assemble the threats. So what can we, there's a difference between the conditions now and the conditions and the circumstances that have led up to those conditions versus in some cases, those conditions won't continue into the future. And so what can we forecast that may not necessarily be a threat now, but it might be a threat tomorrow or 10 years from now. So we tried to compile that information as well. And it's all organized in a way that our staff could use it and access it easily, and this is all available online. So of the universe of population and habitat conditions and threats, we narrowed down to 12 habitat conditions and 14 threats, I hope my count is right there, that we analyzed using the CAP workbook. And because it's a systematic analysis at life stages, at populations, now we're able to compare. And the results provide these scorecards so that we can start looking at what might be limiting in a particular watershed versus what might be limiting across watersheds at a diversity strata or ESU scales. And that helps dictate our recovery actions. So if there's something that needs to be done for a specific restoration project, culvert X needs to be replaced to a bridge here, well, we can do that there, but we can't solve the problem by restoration alone. The adequacy of regulatory mechanisms are key, and in some cases, we need more programmatic, more statewide, more countywide actions to take place to really address some of these issues. And this helps us get us started in that direction. So our recovery actions, we write two separate recovery actions, restoration action to improve a condition, and an action to abate a future threat. Another database, we house all our recovery actions into an Access database, their output into Excel. And we must assign a number, priority, costs, comments, duration that's required. And these, again, all of this information is available to you. For our recovery criteria, we have two separate aspects of criteria, the biological criteria, what we need, how many we need, where we need them, as I mentioned earlier, but we also must have threats criteria. And I'm going to move away from being kind of the technical side of things and being more bureaucratic here. We are pretty unpopular when we start pointing fingers at timber or ag or mining or whatever land use practice there is, but we are obligated under the Endangered Species Act to do so. And the reason why is because when we list a species, delist a species, conduct our five-year status reviews, we do it exclusively for these, what we call these five section 4A1 factors. And those factors are used to determine, A, what's the biological status of the species, but what ultimately are the threats that have led to its decline. And so that's why we must have those two separate criteria. And thus, both the ESA and case law have told us that our recovery plans have to identify these threats. If a threat was identified at the time of listing, whether it be timber harvest or ag, we have to determine the level of that threat now, and if it still remains a threat to the species, what needs to be done to abate it. Our actions and our criteria link to these Federal Register notices listing the species. So once the information is compiled and analyzed, we're trying to output it in ways that are accessible to the public. This is an example of what we call our watershed profiles from the COHO plan, just snapshots of where are we, how many fish do we need for delisting or downlisting, what our conditions are, what our priority actions are for current conditions and threats. And then for Central Coast COHO, we have these maps showing what we call core areas. These are areas where we believe we have extant populations and we need to prevent their extinction now. So focusing restoration in these areas are our highest priorities. We also display our results for the conditions as well as the threats. And just as an FYI, if you double-click on any one of those boxes, there should be comments that behind them, so you can actually see what went into that those ratings. And the hope here is that over time, as things change, we can go back in and use this tool to adapt and change these ratings over time to measure our progress. Recovery actions are output in a word outline as well as an implementation table that gives us priority number, duration, costs, partners, those kinds of information. And our COHO plan is online. So I'm going to just take a few more slides to give you our results, to let you know about our the other two plans that are relevant to this board, the Southern Oregon Northern California Coast COHO recovery plan. Julie Weeder out of the Arcata office is leading that charge. It is due to be finalized at the end of this year, and I encourage you and your staff to work with Julie if you want to see any changes for COHO. For Chinook and Steelhead, that would be me, and we are currently working on it for a co-manager draft. The Water Board and Water Quality are considered co-managers, and you would get a review of that, but hopefully we can be working on that plan regarding our data and information so that the co-manager draft won't be so much of a surprise. Now I will move on to COHO. Only a few slides left. We were not writing a plan for recovery. We were writing a plan to prevent extinction. The species was listed as threatened in 1995, relisted in 1996, relisted in 2005, and it was an extinction prevention plan that we wrote in 2012. There's been a 99% reduction in the total population of this species, and a species that has persisted in abundance for over a million years in one human lifetime is facing extinction. Our recovery scenario for Central Coast COHO from Usaw Creek south to Aptos Creek in Santa Cruz. We need the four diversity strata viable, and we need 39 of a historical 75 persisting or viable. What viable means, we have the spawner density targets, both the downlisting and the delisting targets for each of the watersheds. And we need equal efforts across all four strata, because if we fail in one strata, we fail the ESU. Our priorities, encourage actions that increase the probability of survival at each life stage. Some of the things that we are looking at are captive broodstock programs. We have two, Russian River, and then Scott Creek Monterey Bay Salmon and Trout projects. Focusing areas, our activities in areas where we still have coho populations, and where that is, are private lands. And innovating our approach to private lands is key to the recovery of coho, whether it's conservation banks, whether it's working with timber, timber or foresters or ag. Seeking innovations on these private lands is key. Preserving and sustaining forest lands, protecting base flows, although we don't think necessarily base flow is the biggest problem across the ESU. It's mostly habitat complexity. And then shifting our paradigms, partners and money. Because the situation is dire, but it is not hopeless. We are not the Central Valley. We are coastal communities. We are foresters, we are ag, we are fishermen, and for the most part, our land use practices are quite more compatible than those of probably anywhere else. And we have a whole lot of people who care. Loggers up in Mendocino County dropping wood in streams for coho. We have restoration work in tidal lands. We have our first NIMS conservation bank trying to actually make profit from recovery. We've got miners throwing wood in streams for coho and so many more other activities across the range. There is hope. And so I'm here today to send that message of hope and work with the Water Board and have our agencies work together. While we are different, our purposes are very similar. Sharing, these are just some of my ideas, sharing and centralizing our data sets, and leveraging authorities. The Water Quality and Water Board have different authorities than the ESA. You guys are the cops on the ground giving the speeding tickets. We cannot be out there giving speeding tickets. We're forensics. We come in when there's a fatality. So leveraging each of our authorities to complement and provide more resonance to the work that we do, I think there's a lot of opportunity. Our core areas with waterborne priority, synchronizing those, and looking at practices that have little oversight. Used to be and still am the California Board of Forestry liaison for our agency, and come from timber before my experience here at NIMS. Timber harvest is regulated very well under California Forest Practice Rules, and we have land use practices that are not. So I invite information exchange and information as we work forward on our recovery plan for Chinook and Steelhead, and I also want to compliment the board and the staff here. They are outstanding. The streamlined permitting for small restoration projects is providing an incentive that we don't have for small landowners to participate in co-recovery, and I thank you. The wood for salmon and some of your staff, especially Jonathan Warmerdam and others who have been working on the wood for salmon group and the Garcia, that outreach and that connection in a watershed level and that coordination at a watershed level has made the difference for Coho. And again, thank you, Stephen Barkston and others for working with us on the conservation banking, TMDLs, and the agriculture discharge program. Things are working very well. So next steps. You are important partners. I'm seeking guidance and information on how information that you may have that can help support our recovery and vice versa. We have one ESU for Coho and three water boards, and this is one of our first. This is our first attempt to reach out to a water board, and we wanted it to be you. But we need your guidance on how we can engage those other water boards, because again, we need all four strata working, and they are dealing with a lot of issues in the San Francisco Bay, and it's pretty hard to get attention for a little Coho. And I'd like to close and thank you and introduce you to my great-grandmother, my grandfather, my father, and my daughter. Questions?
Charlotte, thank you very much. John?
Oh, I just had one question. The monitoring programs by the Karuk tribe and the Yurok tribe showed far more migration of your coho smelts, than anticipated, and that actually really changed what tributaries were very, very critical, because mm-hmm. They were down towards the mouth of the river and not too much spawning was occurring there. Are you finding that in other watersheds, that there's this very, very long, rapid mobility if they need to get away from hot water, and so that makes some of the downriver estuary streams more critical than they already were?
Absolutely, absolutely. As a matter of fact, down in Santa Cruz area, our science center has been doing some work to that end, a much smaller scale, of course, and finding that smolts are, our juveniles are moving down into the estuary and then moving back up. And so ensuring consistent water flow, estuarine conditions, you know, suitable, is highly critical. So yes, we're finding that across the range.
Charlotte, I had a question. You know, we have, of course, a broad range of programs out here. It's not perfect, right? We have some in development, as you know, you indicated the ag program and stuff like that. We're kind of getting to this, right? Often a limiting factor out here is, frankly, money. So I'm going to just be bold here and ask, how do we get, because this. There is money for Coho. There is an urgency for Coho, and it's not just about money, of course. But money is on the implementation end, right? And that, how do we leverage what we know, what we need to know, and what we're doing out there now? And I say we, the greater universe on the North Coast. How do we leverage it and get a better participation out there and get the funding to do some of these projects? I think there's a, you know, like I was out on the Garcia recently, like I said earlier, and. You know, there's some wonderful things going on out there. There's wonderful things going on in a lot of watersheds, but there is that limiting factor out there trying to do a whole lot of effort here on a really big and diverse region with diverse land use and diverse problems. And the money part of this thing, frankly, is part of the process that really makes it go. I think we, in my experience, willing landowners out here, we have, I think, a great universe of potential projects out here, and funding is always bottom line, got to be there to make it go around. How do we then leverage with federal government efforts as a state agency and as people out on the ground implementing programs. Can you provide insight into that?
I hope so. First and foremost, it's education, because so many folks, I mean, we're in the Russian River. Everybody knows and understands salmon, but you start getting out beyond that. A lot of people don't know, wow, I have salmon and steelhead in this stream. And as people become more educated and more aware, then they're more willing to make their own investments. Some of the examples that I provide in terms of restoration work, these are on their own dime. The conservation banking that we have, our first for Coho, they put forth a significant amount of funds to get large wood in place, to get the conservation bank in place, to get the monitoring work started before a dime has ever come into that conservation bank. There are a lot of people out there that are willing to spend money on their own dime if they have the hope that what they're doing is going to help Coho. So education, leveraging those people who are willing to spend some of their own money. And then I'm actually excited about our change in merging with the Northwest region, because they have an ability to build that state and stakeholder infrastructure. It's that societal safety net, because as more people understand and care, then more people can bring and leverage their own funding sources from various sources, whether it's private money or whether it's public money, and you can pool those resources together to create probably a really bad analogy, but it's an Eiffel Tower. You're building that infrastructure so that funding can come from multiple sources, and you're organized in a way to use that money and show where the money's going. Because ultimately, we can bring a lot of money in, but people are going to want to know, what's my investment? What am I getting out of that investment, even if it's just the number of fish you're getting back? So there is a structure, but the structure has to be community-based, it has to be local, you know, state and city-based, it has to be organized with the county level, and then the county levels together need to organize with the state. And that's what the Northwest region has done. They have a lot of money coming in from the many, many different resources so that they can afford small forest landowner programs, they can afford having a statewide, very centralized monitoring program in place. But it takes us coming together across those hierarchies to build that Eiffel Tower.
Is this presentation, by the way, available on a website? I mean, there's a ton of information on this thing, and I got to apologize. My eyes don't work as well as they used to, and there's some really small font on this thing. So if I want to look at this, is this up somewhere?
I'm sorry. It wasn't a one-pager like Brian's was.
It's all right.
But I'm happy to provide it in any way necessary. I can probably get it up online on a website.
Okay.
But if there are specific pieces, or you want it in bigger scale, or you have questions about things, you can always call.
Well, and because this also pulls in, you know, work by Fish and Game, work by other agencies, this, you know, stream typing and habitat assessment work that's being done out here. I'm very familiar with our own information and where to go get it, but this information is quite, you know, it's outside of our realm. Mm-hmm. I'm interested, how do we get it out? How do I go get this information? And as a follow-up, I would just request, maybe through our staff, could you please provide some links to this? A lot of great information here.
Thank
right.
you.
And
thank
I had that. Squinty eye problems with it too.
Sorry. My apologies.
It's a chronic condition.
I have it too. I have my glasses here just
well.
In case.
I got to go that way, actually. Any other comments or questions? Charlotte, thank you very much for your efforts. Thanks for your agency efforts. I really like the fact that, you know, this is looking broad spectrum, looking at a variety of ways to get at this and how do we do it. So thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate being
yes. I have one speaker card for Brenda Edelman. I don't have any other speaker cards for this issue that I'm aware of. No.
Brenda Edelman, Russian River Watershed Protection Committee. I really appreciate the presentation, and I know there's a lot of important work that needs to be done, and it's highly complex and difficult, and often there's not enough money to do it. But the one thing I didn't notice, except in one allusion or reference to water quality, and it's been my concern all along for at least 25 years now, that there doesn't seem to be any emphasis or much emphasis on toxicity issues. and specifically endocrine disruption issues. There is huge amounts of information coming out now of the impacts of endocrine disruption on the fish. And I found most of the agencies seem to focus mostly on habitat, and that's not to say that habitat isn't important, but the water quality habitat, to fix one part of it and not address the other part of it in any meaningful way is probably just going to undermine whatever efforts are being done now. So I just want to put that in the mix and also say I'm interested in getting an electronic copy so that I could study this further. I may have missed something that was there, and I just didn't see it. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda. I don't have any other speaker cards, so thank you again, Charlotte, very much for making the trip up here and informing us. Very much appreciate it. We're going to move on to item number 8 and 9, which we are taking together.